Here at Insight Myanmar Podcast, we thank you for joining us for this episode. And I would like to take a moment to welcome listeners who are tuning in today to hear more about... Actually, what am I saying? Let me get out of the way completely so that we can hear directly from the next guest, as this is a great conversation that follows and I don't want to take up an extra second. Victor Chan, thank you for joining us on Insight Myanmar Podcast.
Happy to be here.
I am thrilled to be getting into your story, which covers so many areas, largely covers much of your work in Tibet, although as we'll explore later, there's also some intersections in Myanmar that we'll get to. But I think let's start it off with your early life, because
I have trouble with that name, you know. Myanmar.
Ah, I thought you meant Victor Chen. I was.
I have trouble with that too, but that's you know, it's for later. But
you're a Burma guy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been going there for all this time, and I have a hard time using Myanmar and Yangon, so it's always Burma and Rangoon for me.
Okay, we'll stick to that then.
You don't have to. I'm just giving you my take.
Yeah. Good to get that out right away. Let's before your Tibet journey and intersection happens, if we can learn a bit about your early life. I understand you're from Hong Kong and studied physics and then came to Canada. But if you could pick it up from there and talk a bit about your early years and then what ultimately led you to your first encounter in Tibet.
Well, it's a long story because... even in Hong Kong, Tibet came onto my radar because of a very well-known author by the name of Jin Yong. And if you ask any Chinese, either in Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, anywhere in the diaspora, everybody knows Jin Yong. He wrote some amazing stories focused around martial arts and people with superpowers, but because of practice, because of spiritual practice, because of learning from masters. So in some of his books, they talk about these monks who have superpowers, mostly living in the Himalayas. So Tibet was, as I said, on my radar. And living in Hong Kong, essentially I was living on a rock, a little small rock, though. The outside world was very far away. Growing up in the 40s and 50s, Hong Kong was a bit of a cultural desert. We don't have a lot of outside contact. We don't have New York Times, for example. So by the time I left Hong Kong, went to school in Canada and US, it was a really a big opportunity for me to blow out. to really get into situations that I was very much restricted to living on the rock. So after I graduated, I spent 3 years traveling around the world, quite a bit of that in a Volkswagen camper. So one time I drove from Amsterdam through Europe, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and India. So I was very much part of the lemming, following the hippie trail, going from Europe to India. And a lot of people go to India, like the Beatles and so on. They seek some kind of a spiritual endeavor. I never had that idea. I wasn't into spirituality. I was into sex, rock and roll, and hedonism. So I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and then India. Subsequently, in 72 I was in Afghanistan, then in India after that. And the same year I was in Burma, meeting Mahasi Sayadaw at his retreat center, and then on to Colorado, meeting Chogyam Trungpa, and so on. So for 3 years, I was basically roaming around the world, and I think that was a very much a definitive influence for me that shaped what I did afterwards.
And, you know, you're talking about these years being on what's been called the hippie trail, being with a lot of Western countercultural types. These, what I'm interested in, and these are largely white Western youths that are experimenting and exploring this way.
That's very true, because in all those time that I was in Central Asia, in Turkey, Iran, for example, I never met another Asian person.
How about non-whites, like Hispanic or Black? Was it mainly white?
No. In the early 70s, that idea have not really been filtered down to other nationalities in general.
So how did you feel as an Asian non-white youth going through this exploring with many that were from a different background? Did you feel a sense of inclusion or not so much?
There was no talk about being included or not, because we were all, you know, chasing the same thing. Mm. Good hashish, good LSD, and having a good time and meeting people. You know, that was really the paradigm.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Right. And you say that this was a period of hedonism and pursuing these kinds of pleasures, and yet you also talk about meeting Mahasi Sayadaw at a center in Rangoon, Tibetan monks in Colorado.
I'm a person of multitudes.
Mm. So there was a spiritual dimension.
Not because of my own instigation. I happened to meet a very sophisticated young woman from New York when I was in Kabul. And she was the one who really very much in touch with spirituality. She spent a lot of her time. When I met her in Afghanistan, that was maybe her third time there. She's always been going to places like Nepal and India prior to that to seek out teachers. So she was very much a seeker. Mm. And so I was just someone very wet behind the ears, don't know much about anything. And it was she who introduced me to, in that year, 1972, first to the Dalai Lama in March, and then to Mahasi Sayadaw in Rangoon, and then to Chogyam Trungpa in Colorado. Mm. None of that was my doing. It's all because of this young woman.
Mm. What an experience to meet one after the other in such
all
a short
within
period
a year.
Of time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, what impression did these three make on you?
Well, the most impressive person I ever met in my life was Mahasi Banan.
Why do you say that?
Well, he just have some a very special aura around him, and you can really see that in terms of spiritual work, in terms of practice, he was like a Zen master. He doesn't have to say anything. You stand in front of him, and you feel this aura, this energy, or whatever coming out. And I don't think I can say the same for any other person I've met since. So maybe I was just a very impressionistic young man, and so under the influence and projecting something that wasn't there. But I can tell you that I did not feel the same thing when I met Chogyam Trungpa or when I met the Dalai Lama.
Did it make you want to stay longer and learn from Mahasi?
No, I find the whole Vipassana sitting and meditation very difficult. It was a torture for me to sit on the floor to meditate. So it was not a very pleasant experience. So I didn't really want to prolong that.
But that's just incredible that you've met so many people in your life. You have gone to so many places, and to have Mahasi say it as this towering figure over it all, that's quite a thing to hear. Looking back on that now and on that presence now, you mentioned the kind of youthful potential naivete you had in coming.
I'm still naive.
Okay.
Yeah. Doesn't go away.
Mm. How do
it's
you
always there.
How do you remember that presence now?
The presence of Mahasi?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's very much embedded in me.
Really?
Yeah.
To this day?
To this day.
Just that short interaction?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. So then, moving to Tibet and the Dalai Lama, this is another extraordinary meeting you had that turned into that developed into things that I think no one could have predicted at the time. Talk about how you first met the Dalai Lama and your impression of him.
Well, it was not very auspicious. So this woman that I told you about, this one from New York City, Cheryl. We left Afghanistan. I have to leave my camper behind because it was the time of the Indo-Pakistan War. So, you know, those two countries are always fighting. So because of that, there was no way that I can cross the border to Pakistan and onto India. So we flew from Kabul to, I think, Amritsar or something like that, went to the Golden Temple, and then took a bus to Dharamsala because we have a letter of introduction to the Dalai Lama. So we, arrive on the bus in Dharamsala, and the moment we got out of the bus, we were attacked by all those Indians living in Dharamsala. They all have buckets of color water, water balloons filled with different colors, water, and they start throwing all these things at us. And it was quite an experience to be totally drenched with all these multicolor things. So Cheryl and I, we were the canvas of a Jackson Pollock painting. So that was our introduction to Dharamsala. And then we met the Dalai Lama, and you must know that in those days, not a lot of people know about him. He wasn't the global celebrity that he is now. And so there was hardly any security, to sit down with him was not a big deal. You know, he invited us into his living room. We sat down, and I don't remember too much about it, but I sure remember that most of the time he looked at me and he started to giggle. So his giggle was something that I would always remember that. He could not help himself. So he would be talking Buddhism and stuff like that with Cheryl, and then he'll look across at me and start to giggle again. And he had a hard time trying to suppress it. So that's what I remember.
What sense did you make of why he was giggling at you?
I was a freak. Very long hair. I had on this jalaba from, it must have been from Marrakesh that I bought. You know that, so it's this woolen cape that I had on from basically from my neck all the way to my ankle, and I had the very I had very nice legs, and I had on a pair of very beautiful velvet pants, very form-fitting, but there were always all these patches of what do you call it, patches, yeah, it's from all this wearing. So it was, and I have been on the road for quite some time. So I didn't really have much of a chance to have a shower. So I must not be smelling my best, let's say. So anyway, it was not very often, maybe not even once, that the Dalai Lama met someone like me since his exile, because he crossed the border, across the Himalayas in 1959. And I met him in 1972, so it's 13 years later. So for him to bump up against someone like myself and looking the way I did, and so I guess it's not too surprising that he was giggling all the time.
Right. Now, you...
You would be giggling too, right?
Now, you were meeting him, and you're obviously coming from a Chinese background, and the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans have been persecuted by the mainland Chinese communists. And so, what part did your background start to fit into the conversation?
When he crossed the border, the Himalayas, I remember Life magazine had a photo of him or something like that on its cover. So he was crossing the pass in the Himalayas. He was riding a yak or maybe walking alongside a yak and stuff like that. So I certainly knew that the situation between Tibet and China. And I certainly knew that the Chinese invaded, took over Lhasa, and he has to go into exile. So I wanted to know, and I asked him what he felt about the Chinese who was persecuting him. So that was something that was bugging me and very much in my mind at that time. And all he said was he had no quarrel with the Chinese. It's really the Beijing regime that was a problem for him. And it was it was something that was very clear. It was rock solid. That was how he viewed the Chinese people. And that's of a piece with the way that he think about life, the way he think about people he meet. You know, there's never really any kind of a demarcation between people. And as he always said, everybody have the same wish, same desire. We all want happiness. We don't want suffering. The Chinese are the same. Tibetans are the same. So that came through very clear to me.
Right. And so this interaction with the Dalai Lama, this was the start of a series of collaborations and relationship that would continue up until present day that we're talking. There's a lot there to cover, but share, you know, what happened next in that stage of relationship after meeting that initial time. What drew you back to Tibet? What drew you back to the Dalai Lama or to other Tibetan monks?
Well, I am very sure that after our meeting that the Dalai Lama promptly forgot about me. And I did the same as well. After Dhamsala, we went to Nepal. I trekked around the Annapurna Trek. And then going on to Calcutta, flying from Calcutta to Burma and so on. So after that meeting, he was not in my consciousness. But so it was really quite a bit later when I was traveling in China, when I learned that Tibet for the first time was going to be open to independent traveler. So that was 83, 84. And I always have some, Tibet was the holy grail for people who travel, at least in those days. So everybody wanted to go to Tibet and they have no way of getting there. That all of a sudden, I heard that Tibet is open for independent traveler. So I went straight there in 84. And that was, as I mentioned, that was also in the same year I was able to go to Mount Everest area and then further west to this ancient kingdom of Gugae that I mentioned, and then to do a pilgrimage walk around Mount Kailash. So that was really the start of my exploration of Tibet. And then for the next 4 or 5 years, I spent a lot of time walking to various important pilgrimage sites, but also to go to places in the Himalayas that are quite, that people don't really associate with Tibet. Namely, there are a number of monasteries that I was able to get to that are basically unknown to the world, that still retain an artistic heritage of murals and statues that go back to the 9th, 10th, and 11th century. Mm. And as you know, a lot of the monastic institutions have been destroyed or damaged during the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and the 70s. So to come across some of these places of worship that have still have remnants of art that go back to that time was a very significant part of the book I wrote about Tibet. And then the other part that has importance to me was that I was able to go to all three of the most important pilgrimages that are revered by Tibetan Buddhists. So one, of course, is Mount Kailash, which is the most sacred mountain for both Hindus, Buddhists, Jain, probably the most sacred mountain in the world. And the other two important pilgrimages are one right on the border with Nepal, a pilgrimage called Lhapchi, and then further to the east, the Sari, where there is a very important pilgrimage that basically go along, cross the Himalayas from Tibet into India and then back. This is the area where all the famous British plant hunters went to look for flowers. So it's a botanical paradise and very difficult to get to.
Mm.
And so there are these areas that in together with the pilgrimages, that there's a lot of places to explore. And in the time of 84, 85, 86, for example, where the Chinese did not have computer yet, they do not have a very tight control about tourists, I was able to put on my backpack, walk out of Lhasa, and walk to a lot of these places. So for me, it was very much the golden era of exploring the Himalayas, exploring Tibet, and all its very amazing facets of flowers, plants, vegetation that you never see anywhere else, and also the artistic relevance of some of these places as well.
It's interesting to hear that, because around that same period, we did an interview with, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Joe Cumming, who was one of the first Lonely Planet writers. He wrote for a number of the different Lonely Planet editions, but most famously Thailand. And of course, Thailand is exploding with tourists now. And Joe Cumming wrote the versions that that were exploring places before that
yeah,
mass.
I know about Joe. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So, you know, I think there's an interesting discussion there I had with him, which also relates to yours, but probably even more extreme given Tibet's situation, of what it's like to go into a region that where there aren't maps, so to speak. There aren't, or there might literally be maps, but for the tourist or the pilgrim or the seeker coming in, there's not a clear direction as to where to go, what to find, what it means, what the significance is. And so through not only your own experience and being that trailblazer, but then the work that you're doing to uncover it, to help others to appreciate and find the way that you are, I'm wondering about that process, you know, how you were to determine.
And it's a terrible process. People like Joe, people like me, you know, we have very big egos, and we always wanted to go to places that no one has been before. So we are driven by this desire to be first. And the problem with publications like my own, publications like Lonely Planet, the moment you write about a place, then it starts to become a very much a tourist center type of thing. So you have a sleepy little village in by the sea in Thailand, and all of a sudden after Joe Cummings was there, it got inundated with tourists, and the whole mindset of people changed, the whole way of life of people changed. So that is very much a problem of people who write about places that are, you know, isolated, that not on the beaten path. So I'm very much aware of this problem that we create.
Well, you know, in Joe's case, the reaction to the work he did resulted in a book and then a Leonardo DiCaprio movie called The Beach. That
And you can't go to these places anymore. You know, it's like going to Venice or Barcelona. You know, they really want to limit people going there now.
Right. But so there's a process in, you know, what you choose to write about and what you put on the map, but then there's also the process before that of how you even learn that. And in my conversations with Joe, one of the things that we uncovered that brings in some of my background and experience with it, nothing even close to on a scale what you and him have done, but I spent a number of years writing a meditator's guidebook to Myanmar and exploring a number of the meditative traditions that and some of the important historical sites related to Buddhism and monastic figures there, and the process of coming with a line of inquiry into a place to try to figure out what's left, what's right, what's of interest, how do I even define what interest is? Even that process, I think, is something that is, you know, for in my case, and I was doing it all alone. I don't know to what extent you or Joe had help of colleagues or publishers behind you in what you were doing, but you know, that process of going to a place that just doesn't have that kind of map or layout and trying to determine well how do I find what's of interest and then how do I talk about it? That's a whole process as well, I would imagine.
Well, there's a difference between Joe and I because you take a place like Thailand. He went to a lot of very charming, very interesting, lovely places. He writes about it. And then Leo went there and did his movie. But that's only one thing. The moment he writes about a thing and it's published by Lonely Planet, it's accessible by everybody. Mm-hmm. In my case, only a small fraction of what I write about would be accessible for people today. Yeah. Because the control of tourists going to Tibet is very strict. Mm-hmm. You always have to have a minder, someone who accompanies you and making sure you don't stray off the beaten path. As I mentioned, when I was then 83, 84, 85, and so on, it was the golden era of travel, and I have very little restrictions about where I go. Mm. So I was able to go to all these places. And I can say that the book I published later on, you have seen it. It's 1,100 pages and with very small type.
Yes.
That's a lot of stuff in there.
Yes.
So the places that modern day now that people are able to access is just a very small fraction of what I built. So I don't think that I did as much damage as Joe did.
Thanks to the Chinese Communist Party, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So then another part of this is in your own personal journey, you talk about the prior decade being on this this hippie trail in search of good drugs and sex and experiences and everything else with the spiritual element thrown in there. But then when you're going to Tibet, a number of years have passed in your life. This is, and the work you're doing in Tibet, it's, this is serious work. This is serious academic and detailed work that you're undertaking. This is not a light simply going here and there and taking some pictures and jotting down some notes. And so how would you describe your own personal evolution or perhaps maturation or if your priorities kind of shifted and how you saw travel and your responsibilities or interest in that travel as to contrasting it a decade earlier on the hippie trail?
Well, it's a bit of a strange thing, and it's something that I have yet to fathom, which is that, I grew up in a very fairly traditional Chinese family in Hong Kong, and so there's nothing really unusual about it. So I always wonder, to some extent, why I had this very strong nomadic type of instinct that even today, when I am in my 80s, I still want to travel, to explore, and to go off the beaten path. And I look back at my peers, people who went to class with me, went to school with me in Hong Kong. The only thing they ever want to do is go on a cruise. And I have never been on a cruise, and I don't intend to go on a cruise. So, you know, there are a few of us who we communicate regularly. People who went to kindergarten with me, so people I've known for over 7 decades, and these are the people who sit in their homes and they watch TV and they go on the internet and they scroll over all kinds of things. So I'm just wondering, why is it that I am rather different from them, having this nomadic gene, it seemed that I have. Yeah, so I'm not quite sure I'm answering your question, but this is something I need to excavate and find out for myself, what happened, you know, what are some of the catalysts that drove me to risking life and limb, because a lot of places I've been to in Tibet, for example, I crossed into Nepal, into Tibet, via a very wet and very slippery tree trunk over a raging river. And I fully realized that one slip and I'm in that river and I'm gone. No one would ever know there's a Victor Chan falling down the river in this very isolated part of the Himalayas. So there are some real physical risks involved, and I have this propensity to take risk. I think both mental and physical as well. So, for example, people who grew up in traditional Chinese household in Hong Kong, like I did, for example, in the late 60s or 70s, when you talk about things like marijuana, there is one word that lump everything together, and that word in Chinese is poison. So that is the mindset of my peers in Hong Kong, that generation. And the older generation as well, they would never dare to, and also because of the Opium War, there's a lot of bad stuff happening, and so there's a lot of bad connotation about it. All I'm saying is that my classmates, for example, the people I went to school with, would never dare to mess with their minds and take mind-altering drugs. So that just wasn't done. So I took risk, not only physically but also mentally as well. So I am trying to understand what happened.
But I imagine that there also would have been a maturation process from your experiences on the hippie trail to writing an 1,100-page
That's
guidebook.
where I stop you. I don't know about maturation process because I'm still consider myself pretty immature to this day. So yeah, no, yeah. I mean, the maturation in process in the sense that I am more careful about taking physical risks because I don't want to be injured and break my hip, for example. So, you know, that's something I keep in mind sure. more.
Well, I mean, maybe there's different definitions of the word mature, but what I'm driving at is that it's no small feat to write an 1,100-page book in small print about a region that no one has ever been to before and the kind of focus and detail and effort that takes. That's a really serious endeavor. So something in you must have risen to the occasion, both of being capable of doing it and wanting to do it, because that's a big task for anyone to even consider.
I just didn't know any better. That there are other things in life than to travel around Tibet and write about it. Mm. I mean, there's no money involved, hardly,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
That strangely has quite a resonance for me, because that's pretty much how I would describe the effort I took to map some of the meditation traditions in Burma and create a guidebook, which was a project far too ambitious than what I was capable of doing once I realized I was getting into, and yet I kind of didn't know anything better to do because it just landed on me. So somehow that's a very satisfying answer. The book that you wrote, it received quite a number of accolades and is still referenced today. One of them from Michael Aris, who was a Tibetan scholar and also the late husband of Aung San Suu Kyi. Talk about your relationship with Michael Aris, and then through that, the Aung San Suu Kyi family.
It was really through a guy, a professor at Oxford that I met in Kathmandu in the early 80s. He was living there, and he was doing his research on the Bon religion of Nepal. His name is Charles Rambo. He's a very well-known Tibetologist. And so he has a house in Tibet, in Kathmandu. I have a house in Kathmandu, and you know, we know each other well. But he has never really, his exploration, his research are mostly in, for example, the Dopo area of Nepal. And he, you know, because I was in Tibet in 84, 85, and so on, I was the person who came back to Kathmandu with a lot of information about Mount Kailash and the places I went to, monasteries and so on. And his research was very focused on the Bonpo religion, which is the religion that predates Buddhism. One of the most important sacred places of the Bonpo religion is in Tibet, and it's a mountain called Bonri. And so at one point, he and I went there, and again, I am sorry to say that we were the first foreigners to get to that mountain. See, this is where the ego comes again around, that we like to go to places first. So we circumambulated the mountain, and we travel around the region. And then we bump into a French guy and his wife. And the French guy's name is Michel Pacel. And he's another one of those guys with big ego, wanted to go to places where no one has been. And he has a doctorate from the Sorbonne, from Oxford, and he's quite the famous explorer of the Himalayas. And his dissertation, I think, at Oxford was about the ancient kingdom of Mustang, and it was in, I think, in the early 60s that he published a book that described his exploration of this kingdom, which is a part of Nepal, but very much his own Tibetan kingdom. Mm-hmm. So the book is called The Kingdom of Mustang. It was a big seller, translated into many different languages. And to this day, Mustang is still one of the most fascinating part of Nepal. So we met up with him in the eastern part of Tibet, and we started to travel together because I had in mind to go into this very difficult area to access, which is, you know, Tibet is basically drained by this big river that goes from Mount Kailash all the way to the eastern part of Tibet, and then it makes a U-turn, the river, and then come down into India and became the Brahmaputra. So this bend, the reason why this river, big river, bends around like this is because there are two very big mountains on either side of it at the bend. So Giripiri is one, Namche Bawa is another one. They're all 8,500 meters high, and it forced the river to come down, and then it descends from the plateau, which is 14,000 feet, and all the way down 9,000, 6,000 into the Indian subcontinent. So that is the very area where no one has ever been, and it's the richest area that I know of the flora and the fauna of the Himalayas. Mm. So Michel Pichel wanted to explore the area. I wanted to go to the area together with Charles Rambo. Mm. So we off we went. Mm. But then Michel is the one of the means, and he has a whole entourage of yaks and horses and porters to support that exploration. And Charles Rambo and I basically was tagging along. That's kind of the things that we do in Tibet in those days, where the control of the Chinese of Tibet was not very complete or strict at that time. So we were able to do things like this. Michael Ahrens, it's Charles Rambo was his PhD student. So Charles and Michael have a very, very long, strong relationship. And then, so from time to time, Michael and Aung San Suu Kyi and their kids would also go to Nepal to visit with Charles. Their kids were very young, you know, they're just, they're a few years of age at the time. So that was when I met the family. So I had that relation with Michael and Aung San Suu Kyi, and when I finished the Tibet book, Michael was very generous in giving me a blurb. And then, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi got her Nobel Prize, and then the kind of headwind that she suffered from the, as you mentioned earlier on. But then over 10 years ago, I was invited to speak at her the first ever literary festival in Rangoon, and of which she was the patron. So I met up with her again and spent some time there. And then I think that was the last time I went to Burma.
Mm-hmm. So you would have met Aung San Suu Kyi long before she was in the public eye, and long before 1988, when she was a young mother with very young children. So what were your impressions of her at that time?
Well, I think the sense I got was that she and Michael have a very strong relationship, but it was dominated by Michael because he was the professor at Oxford. He was really the big deal there, and Aung San Suu Kyi, she was quite a relative unknown at that time, And I think the idea of her going back to her country and to be an activist and to be involved in the movement, for example, was still a little bit of a figment of her imagination at the time.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. So it was really later on that she really got to a lot of thinking about her own father, who was a very important general in the country. So at the time that I met her, she wasn't really thinking about that. And then Michael had the health issue, and so she, I guess that's when she started really thinking about her purpose in life.
Yeah, yeah. And so then when you were with her, I'm also curious, you know, because it would have been before the big movements of the 88 protests and everything that came after. Did conversations come up about kind of what was going on in Burma at that time in the 1980s, or what she felt about it, or she had any role in it? Did, was Burma on the topic of conversations at all?
No, no, it's really more about Tibet. I mean, Michael is the one who was the tutor to the royal family in Bhutan, for example, and Michael and Charles Rambo, they are the ones who are really keen on the Himalayas and Tibet, Bhutan, and so on. So it was not something that Sue was so invested in. No, we didn't really talk about Burma.
Right. When you saw the trajectory that she would then be on in 88 and afterwards and all the decades, were you surprised?
Well, it's I guess it was in a way fairly natural, because a lot of her influences was in the West, you know. Living with Michael in Oxford, and very much influenced by the whole Great Britain type of culture, and the thing about her is really what I really picked up was after the Nobel Prize. And I remember the Dalai Lama being so enamored with her.
Really?
Really very respectful of her work, her getting the Nobel Prize. And then I spent quite a bit of time with people like Desmond Tutu, for example, also. And they all consider her like part of the family. She was like a sister to, especially to Archbishop Tutu. The Dalai Lama really thought very highly of her, always talking about her, very impressed with her. And then, of course, you know, the turnaround, the way that she have different views about the situation in Burma. So that was when there were a lot of pushback, right, from different places. They're talking about taking back her Nobel Prize and all that stuff. And I think that Tutu was probably a little bit disappointed by her turn around, whereas the Dalai Lama always, you know, we met with her in various occasions. For example, when Václav Havel was having his conferences in Prague, so Aung San Suu Kyi was there, and the Dalai Lama and I were there. And there's always my feeling that the sentiment of the Dalai Lama about her has never really deviated. He always respected her for what she did.
That's really interesting. I'm also struck by you paint this picture in Tibet of Michael and Charles being these kind of superstars and the the Oxford connections, the Tibet expertise that they're showing, and Burma being off the radar, Aung San Suu Kyi being somewhat known but not very much as the daughter of the of a very important figure in the country, but really taking like a back seat, it, perhaps in the marriage, perhaps in the social scenes as well. Did am I reading that right? Is that something you felt that she was that she was a bit sidelined?
I don't know whether she was sidelined because she is a very strong personality,
Okay,
you know,
even then.
even then. But then, when you're going around the dinner parties at
Right.
Oxford or London, for example, these are mostly Michael's people,
I see.
right?
I see.
So Michael was a star, and at that point in time,
Right.
Burma was not really very strong in people's consciousness.
She didn't have much to contribute, partly because nothing much was going on in Burma, and partly because she did at that point she didn't have any role in the little that was going on. So there wasn't a heavy contribution for from her on that topic. So then when she was so she went to Burma in 1988 to care for her ailing mother, and it just so happened she did not go there to be a revolutionary or a leader. It just so happened that the 88 movement kickstarted when she was taking care of her mother in the hospital, and then, as we say, the rest was history. And she decided to stay, and virtually has stayed ever since. Were you? I don't know how close you were with Michael and corresponding with him, but from 88 on, when he was in the tragic circumstances of when he was dying and was un was they were unable to see each other, were you ever in touch with Michael about the separation and Aung San Suu Kyi's decision to basically be preferencing her country's future and her role in it over her marriage? I mean, that's a devastating choice for anyone to have to make.
As you know, Michael has a twin brother, Anthony. So Anthony Ellis is a very well-known publisher in London, and his company is called Serindia, and they publish a lot of books about Tibet, the subcontinent, the Himalayas, and so on. And I know Anthony much more than Michael, because I was at some point working on a book with Anthony. So I know him and his wife, Mary Law, quite well. Anthony is dead now also, but Mary Law is still living in London. She's French. So I spend quite a bit of time, you know, whenever I go to London, I'll meet with them. So they are very aware of the situation in Burma. You know, they are very close to Aung San Suu Kyi as well. So it's really through Anthony and his family that I kept apprised of what is happening. And the reason why I was working with Anthony on a book was because in Kathmandu, I was living, I was sharing a house with an Italian couple, and Roby and Chichi. And when I came back from Tibet for the first time after I went to Kailash, they were the people who were very eager to know something about Kailash. And as I mentioned, you know, it was a very much unknown place at the time. So Roby and Chichi was always wanting to talk to me about Tibet, the situation, and so on. And and then we share a house together. Roby has been a very quite a connoisseur of Himalayan art. He just have an incredible eye for that, really hypersensitive to the artistic current of the Himalayas, and especially the Tibetan ones. And I met him in 84 when I came back from Tibet. And then he started to really get into the Tibetan culture, and he taught himself Tibetan. And then over time, in a very short time, very bright, he became totally fluent in Tibetan, especially the written part of it. And he did a lot of very original research into Tibetan culture, Tibetan history, Tibetan art, and so on. And I traveled with him, and it's because of him that I was able to have some understanding of some of the Tibetan art that I told you about that dates back from to the 9th and 11th century, places that are really totally unknown.
I see.
And the reason I brought about that is because we worked together with Anthony Ayres on this book about Tibet, which no one had written about before, which is about the early temple of Tibet. Most of them are unknown to people, and there's maybe a dozen of them. And so it was, the project was driven by Roby, this person who knows Tibetan and who really got very deep into Tibetan history. So we were supposed to collaborate to do this book together with and to be published by Anthony Ayres. But after a while, we came to the realization that Victor is just a sidekick in there. There's no real contribution that Victor can give to the book. So I got myself out of the situation, and the book, The Early Temples of Tibet, was really totally Roby's work, because he got into the history, he knows about the art, and so it was from that point that he started to do more books. And one of the books that he subsequently authored was around this kingdom of Gugye that I told you about. It's a very important part of Tibetan history, this Western Tibet kingdom and the temples in the area. So all these came afterwards.
So then moving on to expand more on your Tibet work, you write this extraordinary guide, and you've gone into some of the relationships and work that you had in order to produce that. But then another part of this story, there's so many other threads there to explore in your longstanding relationship with Tibet, but is your personal relationship with the Dalai Lama, which is a continued relationship of collaboration and conversation and so many other things. So you had mentioned that after you first met the Dalai Lama, that he probably forgot mostly about you and you moved on with your life, and yet you keep coming back together. So talk about where that relationship with the Dalai Lama then went in those subsequent years.
Well, it's very much a given that when I first met him, he was a relative unknown. He didn't get a Nobel Prize. He only got the prize in 89. And also, he was the perhaps the only foreigner of note that he has met in those early years was, I met him in 72, and it was 4 years prior that Thomas Merton spent all this time with him. Do you know Thomas Merton?
No.
So Thomas Merton went to Dharamsala, met with him, and they became soulmates very fast. You know, it was a very great opportunity for the Dalai Lama to meet with someone like Thomas Merton, who can tell him a lot about Christianity, for example. And Thomas Merton was, of course, very fascinated by the Dalai Lama. So that was just about, he left in 59, and in 68, he met Thomas Merton. So that was quite a pivotal point for the Dalai Lama. And of course, Thomas Merton died very soon after in Thailand.
Mm.
So that was a significant point in the Dalai Lama at that time. And then later on, it was in 1979, that he first went to the U.S. So that was when things really started to happen. You know, he had all these invitations to go to Europe, to America, and so on, and became more and more well known. And then 89, he had the Nobel Prize. So what I'm saying is that I was really a nobody. You know, I have no claim to fame. Mm. I didn't write any book. I was not a scholar. Certainly not the Thomas Merton. So, you know, it's very natural that he met me and then he forgot me right away. And then later on, when I finished the Tibet book, I had a launch of the book in London. And at the launch, I went, he happened to be in London also, so I went to his hotel and hoped to meet up with him, and me and hundreds of other people were trying to say hello to him, and I was able to give him my book. So he took the book from me and looked at it, and he said, "Very good, very good," and then passed it on to his assistant, and then he went to the elevator and went up to his room, and that was it. So really, you know, the meetings are not really of much note for him. He didn't really know what I did with the book because, you know, he just saw this thing and a lot of people give him things and he just passed it on to his assistant. But it was afterwards that we met up again in the U.S. and I make the pitch of to collaborate with him on books, and he agreed to it.
So which books did you collaborate on?
Well, the first one was The Wisdom of Forgiveness, and that was published in 2004, of which you guys have a copy. And then the second one was The Wisdom of Compassion, came out in 2012. And we are talking about doing the process now.
So there's so much media that's been put out about the Dalai Lama, and so much understanding that's come of him since those early days. As you say, he was an unknown when you met him, and he's definitely not that now. So when you came to work on these two books, what angle or what content were you after in getting the Dalai Lama's views or life on those pages that you wanted to be unique from all the other coverage and all the other writings that involve him?
I think that in the collaboration with him, I traveled with him a lot. Various European countries, India, Canada. I invited him to Vancouver 4 times. Have a lot of one-on-one interviews with him in Dharamsala. Break bread with him. You know, so a lot of encounters. Mm-hmm. He has, if you go to Amazon, you would find that there are a lot of books associated with him.
Yes, yes.
People who have recorded his lecture and then transcribed the thing and then edited down, and then it's a book. So there are a lot of things like this. He himself has wrote a few books that he's really very invested in. The sense I got is that the communication of what he tried to say, the wisdom he's trying to impart, the insight he wants to get out to people, that is a hit and miss thing. For one thing, his English is not that good, so for him to really go into some depth and explain some of the key ideas of Buddhism is not an easy thing for him. So the focus I had in these books is really to tell stories. And it is through the stories of my encounter with him, the people we meet, the travel we did, through stories like this. For example, meeting with, spending some time with Archbishop Tutu, for example. It's really through the story I try to endeavor to sneak in some of his wisdom, sneak right. in some of his insight in a way that is palatable and accessible to people on the street.
It almost sounds like a modern day sutta.
So this is really what I focus on, to take the idea of emptiness, for example, and couch it in such a way that people can relate to, which is not an easy thing to do. Yeah. So, but this is something that I'm always keeping in mind, to paint that picture for people. So I avoid at all costs any kind of a Buddhist jargon. Terminology, and so this is really what I focus on, to tell stories.
We've talked about being in the presence of certain individuals. You mentioned Mahasi Sayadaw. You've been around the Dalai Lama now going back decades, being in his presence, seeing his interactions in any number of situations with any number of people and contexts. How would you describe the experience of being in his presence and what his aura gives off?
I certainly don't think that I much consider any kind of an aura from him. It was a collaboration. You know, it's I'm happy that he allowed me to be embedded into his entourage. When he traveled around the world. And it was certainly nothing like how I felt with Mahasi Sayadaw. And so most of the time is observing him and then seeing how he interacts with people, the kind of things that he's most invested in. How he relates to people, how he makes friends, and you know, over the decades, you know, when I'm with him, he's met thousands of people, and sometimes just a matter of hello and a matter of a minute or two, and then I often see how people were profoundly affected by his presence. So tears would come, and there would be a lot of emotions involved, even from a simple gesture of a handshake or a word or two. So that's also of interest to me, in the sense that I am wondering, why are people so emotional and so affected by being in his presence? So is this something that because of he's a celebrity, people have projections of him, people have been thinking about him, people have been reading about him, and then finally being in his presence, something happens. So this is something that is always of interest. That's one woman I met fairly recently. She had a difficult childhood because when she was 17, she was conscripted into the Tanzania army of Indian descent. So that was the time when Uganda under Idi Amin was invading Tanzania and, you know, throwing their weight around. And so she was conscripted to be in the Ugandan army at 17 years of age. Can you imagine a young woman being in the army? And so it was a terrible situation for me, for her. And she was able to escape, and she actually was able to come to Canada. But all her life she has been afflicted with terrible anxiety and depression, and she tried to kill herself 3 times over the years. The last time trying to jump off a very tall building in Vancouver. And then one time a friend of her took her to see the Dalai Lama giving a talk at the PNE. So they got a ticket, she went there, she was at the event, and that changes her life. All the anxiety, all the depression, all the suicidal attempts gone, just being in the audience with the Dalai Lama a few hundred meters away. And so, you know, it was a bit of a miracle, but you know, things like this happen. So it's of interest to me of really at the end of the day to excavate this idea of the effect he has on people.
What do you make of it? Why do you think he has that effect?
People carry their own baggage around with them, you know, the prior stuff, conditioning. And maybe people take it with them when they meet with him. You know, who knows? There's no real rational explanation. And there's always the sense that people are looking for something that is larger than their life, you know. So to meet someone like this is a big deal.
Right. You had mentioned in your earlier years that you did not have this interest in spirituality so much, although you just kind of went where the wind blew. You rejected the possibility of a maturation, saying that you're still quite immature and still have and still working on that part. But do you feel that do you feel that your spiritual qualities or your interest in spirituality has grown or transformed as you have aged, and also as you have come in contact with people of this manner?
Well, very early on, though, I have always been very influenced by Zen. So at college, people like Alan Watts, writing, for example, is something that I relate to. And then later on, Ram Dass writing, Be Here Now, his book, for example. So that I read that in maybe 1971 or something like this. So they have an effect on me. So I have always been quite interested in Zen, which is so different from Tibetan Buddhism, mm-hmm. for example.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of being mindful, being able to get into the flow, you know, I learned walking meditation with Maharshi Sayadaw in Rangoon.
Mm.
Did a lot of walking in the Himalayas, so mindful walking has always been very much a part of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't go into the very doctrinal aspect of,
yeah.
of Buddhism and
yeah.
all the, you know, the there's a lot of stuff in there mm-hmm. which I am unable to access and not also not very interested.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea of being able taught walking meditation in with Maharshi in Rangoon, that has always stayed with me, and that's why I was able to do a lot of walking in Tibet, even carrying 40-50 pounds of gear on my back, right? So that helped me a lot. And the other aspect, I don't go into formal meditation. I find sitting on the floor is not my cup of tea. It's pure torture. But what I do is I swim every day, and swimming is a form of meditation for me. I'm very mindful. There's a lot of technique involved, there's a lot of subtlety about swimming, and I get into that. So that would be my meditation.
You're referencing to being with Maharshi Sayadaw reminds me of another anecdote you might find amusing. I have a good friend who ordained with Maharshi in 1980. And referenced as being a young backpacker, spiritual seeker, having spent time with Ajahn Chah and just in Thailand, and just kind of looking for a teacher to learn under. And as with you, was quite taken with Maharshi when he was at a center, and was given very strict instructions when he ordained to how intently to focus on the practice and to keep the eyes downcast. And so he adhered to that the entire time he was at the center. It might have been 2 weeks or something that he was there. And as he was walking with the kind of attentive mindfulness that he was instructed, he always saw Maharshi standing in the same place without moving a muscle, and was really taken with this and taken with the seriousness of the discipline and the presence and the movements, and any time he walked by this area, it was always Maharshi Sayadaw standing exactly at that posture without taking a breath, never moving, always in that exact same spot. And it wasn't until he finally left and got his bags that he came to find that was a statue of Maharshi Sayadaw. And because he had not allowed himself to lift up his head, he had projected all of this onto how powerful his presence was. So that was always a story that stuck with me.
So he got ordained, huh, by Maharshi himself?
He's virtually been in Myanmar ever since. His story of what he went on to do in Myanmar is one of the most incredible stories that I've ever recorded, and one of the most incredible stories not to be released, because Myanmar has since become unsafe, as we all know, and he did not feel safe having the intricacies of his story out there. So it's one of our lost treasures that may or may not one day find light. Yeah. So then, as we're talking about your relationship with Dr. Maharshi Sayadaw and Dalai Lama, there's this third Tibetan monk in Colorado that you referenced at the beginning of the discussion that you also were able to meet within the course of a year. Talk about him and your relationship with him.
Well, there was it wasn't much of a relation. I was as I told you, I was started to travel with Cheryl, this woman from New York City, and she lived in New York, Colorado, Boulder, and she was one of the first disciples of Chogyam Trungpa.
Mm.
And she basically took me there to introduce me to him. But I didn't really stay long with the teachings that he was holding in Colorado. Then Cheryl and I went to New York after that, and then I went back to Canada, and we split up. So I don't really have any very substantial relation with Chogyam Trungpa. But I know some of the people involved. Cheryl was very close to him, and we all know about his very crazy aspect of crazy wisdom, right, for example. I met his wife, Diana. They were living in a house in the Boulder area. And so that was a very superficial type of relationship.
His presence and legacy is quite interesting. The only anecdote I had that I heard about him, and I spent a lot of time going in and out of Boulder. I've never been so involved in the Tibetan side of things personally, but I stayed with someone who was studying Tibetan practice, and he told, I don't know if this happened to him or if he was reporting it secondhand, but he talked about an incident where he came to speak at an auditorium, and it was a massive crowd, and this guy and his friend were in the very back of a very big crowd, and he came out, you know, just drunk and staggering and barely able to stand. And as he was staggering to the microphone in this very back of the auditorium, this one guy that was telling the story whispered to his friend, "Oh, this is disgraceful. Can you believe this? It's supposed to be a monk giving us this wisdom, and he could barely walk to the mic stand," whispering this in the friend's ear. And the minute after he finished, he was at the microphone and looking directly at the two people who were whispering in the back. And I don't remember exactly what was reported he said, but something to the fact that intoxicants do not have a relation to the power and the development of the mind. And these two were just absolutely shocked. And I think there are a number of stories like that about his crazy wisdom.
I am essentially forever basking in the reflected glory of the Dalai Lama. As I said, I mentioned I was able to bring him to Vancouver four times. So because of his star power, I'm able to get other people coming to Vancouver in those days. We have Desmond Tutu, Shirin Ebadi, and a whole bunch of other Nobel Peace Prize people. I had Eckhart Tolle on a panel with him, together with Gelman.
I saw you had Karen Armstrong too.
Yeah, that too. And Murray Gell-Mann was the giant in particle physics in the 50s and 60s. He was the guy who coined the quark particle,
okay,
for example.
Right.
So he's also someone who can speak 30 plus languages fluently.
Goodness.
You know? So amazing mind.
Yeah.
So I was able to bring people like Karen Armstrong, him, you know, to the table.
It's awesome.
But that is very different from the people I bring to the table when I'm doing these dinners, these things.
Right.
You know, it's a totally different thing altogether.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, I love both of these because as we see here, this is the art of the conversation, the belief in the power of communication as a transforming force. And these are two examples of communication and conversation you have brought in very different kinds of formats, both in a very public setting with, extremely high profile people that I think probably the residents of city in Vancouver are personally grateful for you and being able to facilitate this kind of visit. But then much more private, you facilitate these dinners that are also based on conversation with 16 individuals that I also just found beautiful and fascinating. If you could share the belief behind that.
Well, I think it goes back to when I was in college. I fell in with a very cosmopolitan crowd. Mm. And I find that, you know, these are the people from Belgium, France, New Zealand, and so on. They tend to hold conversation very differently from most Canadian kids at the at the university. So there's a lot of in-depth drilling down on topics that may or may not be very relevant to people's life. But the whole idea is really to lean in to any particular topic at all and to have a real give and take, to listen deeply and to come up with something of interest to say. So I was quite taken with more of this type of conversation instead of the weather and, you know, talking about whatever. Mm. So I started doing this again in this private club I told you for nearly 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so it really takes me back, give me that the pleasure of sitting down, breaking bread with people, have a glass of wine, and to listen deeply and to have a conversation about loneliness, about social isolation, about purpose in life, about happiness, about psychedelics, you know, a whole range of very eclectic type of topic. And it's really gratifying to have people who understand the idea behind it so that it's not a lecture, but a real conversation where people have to listen and to really be involved. So it gave me a lot of pleasure.
You were mentioning the wealth of conversation you had. I responded by saying, oh boy, you must have really learned a lot from this. And your response was that it wasn't about learning, it was about the act of conversation. And that stayed with me. It's going to stay with me because it's flipping the table on interaction as knowledge acquisition and looking at interaction as a process between people. And so I wanted to ask if you could flesh out why, in the way you look at this conversation, how in rejecting it being about learning something or knowledge acquisition, what is it about instead for you? What is that process which makes it so valuable, if not that?
I think, you know, I have some responsibility to myself in a situation like this. I also have responsibility to the speaker, whoever that may be, to make sure that it's an experience that is reasonably pleasurable for the speaker. And then thirdly, to responsibility to all the participants who signed up to be at the table. So I am very much cognizant that if someone signed up for a dinner, of course, there's an aspect of knowing something about mindfulness, for example. There's that. We all have that aspiration to learn something. But then, I think for most people, the big thing is they like the delight in having something to say and then have the courage to say it in front of, you know, 16 people. So that is something that is very nourishing you know, for the mind, for the spirit, whatever. And then, of course, most of us, myself especially, like to hear our own voice. So, you know, this is what drives the evening. So just to have someone come in and deliver a lecture for an hour or so, and where you're passively, basically, like a kid at university taking in a lecture. You know, these are all, you know, older people. This is not what they have in mind. And so it's a real give and take that is good about it.
Well, I hope that this conversation has also been a fulfilling one for you to take part of, and I appreciate you know, your involvement and opening up your story.
You asked a good question, so that's good.
Yeah, thank you.
It catalyzed a conversation. So yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. That means a lot coming from you. And indeed, the questions you ask and the way you ask them are immensely important. I've gone into training of digital storytelling and Burmese Host that we're bringing as part of this platform, and we look at all aspects of what it means to hold a conversation, to genuinely put yourself out there and be involved, and to bring listeners in. And one of those essential elements that we talk about quite a bit is the construction of questions and what it means to connect active listening with a genuine curiosity and then put that in question form. And it is a deceptively challenging and incredibly difficult thing to do right. And I am always trying to improve, and I'm always self-critical in the moment of how do I bring all of these concepts into something this concise and
good,
direct.
Good aspiration. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still working on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But I appreciate you for joining this conversation, for how it turned on. I immensely enjoyed it, and not only the exchange of it, but I will confess that I learned a lot. And thank you for your time.
I'll be sending you a bill.
Okay.
I enjoyed that very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. Each episode we produce is offered freely and always will be. Our goal is to inform, engage, and inspire as many people as possible with stories and voices that matter. And thanks to your support, we've been able to reach tens of thousands of listeners across the globe. This is truly remarkable. But to sustain this momentum, we need your help. Even if just a small percentage of our listeners committed to a very modest monthly pledge, we would not only be able to sustain our momentum, but grow. Even better, you might consider becoming a member to deepen your engagement with this platform and thereby gain access to additional content and other exclusive benefits. So, if you found value in what we offer and want to help secure the future of this work, however you want to make that happen, please visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to make a pledge, or navigate to insightmyanmar.org/membership to look at our member options. With your help, we can keep this work alive and thriving. Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,